The subject of this chemistry cassette presentation is symmetry in chemistry, and the speaker is Sidney Kettle, Professor of Inorganic and Theoretical Chemistry in the University of East Anglia. During his talk, Professor Kettle refers frequently to the booklet which accompanies the cassette, and you should have this, together with pencil and paper, as you work. And before you proceed any further, please make certain that you've read the section in the booklet entitled How to Use the Chemistry Cassette. And now here is Professor Kettle.
In this tape, I'm going to attempt to show you some of the ways in which understanding the symmetry of molecules helps you to understand their chemistry as well. Many molecules, such as methane or sulfur hexafluoride, are highly symmetric. Others, whilst not so symmetric, at least approximate to a high symmetry. So, it's easy to think of a large number of complexes of transition metal ions which are approximately octahedral. It turns out that many of the properties of a molecule are determined, at least in pretty large measure, by the symmetry properties of the molecule. Certainly, an understanding of their symmetry properties helps to simplify discussions of the bonding in molecules, to interpret spectra of all types associated with them, and even helps you to understand, at least qualitatively, the relative rates of some chemical reactions. For instance, the 3N-6 rule tells us that the water molecule has three vibrational modes, but it doesn't tell us what they look like, nor does it tell us whether we should expect to see peaks corresponding to them in the infrared or the Raman spectra. Symmetry theory does tell us something about these things, and we shall look at them in detail later on in this tape. The theory that we shall be talking about is really a mathematical theory. It's group theory. The mathematical theory of groups can be a very abstract and rather difficult subject. It's obviously also difficult to give mathematics in a presentation like this, and anyhow, I think most chemists find that a mathematical treatment isn't always helpful, at least not initially. So, in the present treatment, what I shall do is to use qualitative arguments and diagrams in the booklet to arrive at results which are really mathematical. There will be some points, of course, where I really need the mathematics, and there I shall have to fudge things just a little bit. Maybe later in your course you'll come across the mathematics. I hope so, because it will really illuminate and help you to understand the basis of the theory that I'm talking about. However, I hope the presentation which I give on this tape will help you to go to the stage at which virtually all of the applications of group theory which are of interest to a chemist will be available to you. Frame 1 in the booklet shows in outline the ground we shall be covering, together with definitions of some of the jargon words we shall be using. Don't attempt to memorize the frame, or indeed to understand all of the definitions, but stop the tape for a few minutes to read the frame and to try to get some idea of where we're going. To start, we must ask a question about symmetry. What is symmetry? What do I mean when I say that a molecule has high symmetry? There are two aspects of the answer to this between which we've got to distinguish. The first concerns symmetry elements. Symmetry elements are defined in frame 2. They are things like a rotation axis, a mirror plane, or a center of symmetry. A rotation axis may be thought of as if it were like the axle of a wheel. Rotate an object about an axis of symmetry, and eventually it reaches a position at which it looks just the same as it did before you started the rotation. It may do this 2 or 3 or more times in a complete rotation. We then refer to 2-fold, 3-fold, 4-fold axes, and so on. A mirror plane is well described by its name. Mirror planes always divide objects into two parts, each part being the mirror image of the other. That is, reflection of an object in a mirror plane of symmetry will regenerate the object unchanged. There are other types of symmetry elements, as we shall see. Symmetry elements can usually be thought of as corresponding to some physical object, a plane in the case of a mirror plane, a line in the case of the rotation axis, and a point for the case of a center of symmetry. Perhaps the most obvious thing to do, then, in defining the symmetry of an object is to list the symmetry elements which an object possesses. This is an important first step, but as we shall see, there's a yet more fundamental step, that of relating each symmetry element to the corresponding symmetry operation. If the symmetry element is thought of as an object, then the symmetry operation is the carrying out of the act implied by that object, the act of carrying out a rotation, the act of reflecting, of reflection, and so on. For a short while, I shall be concerned entirely with symmetry elements, but the vast body of this tape will be concerned with symmetry operations. The reason why we need to distinguish between them won't be clear to you at the moment, but it should become clearer as we go on. The five kinds of symmetry element which a molecule may possess are listed in frame 3. Let's first have a quick look at them and then consider each in more detail. The first symmetry element is a rotation axis of symmetry, as it's shown in frame 4. This is perhaps the most common symmetry element possessed by molecules. Frame 4 shows that an isosceles triangle has a twofold axis, an equilateral triangle a threefold axis, and that a square has a fourfold axis. As I've shown you in that frame, these axes of symmetry are denoted by the capital letter C with a number used as a suffix. So, for the square, you talk about the C subscript 4 axis, which we shall simply call a C4 axis, meaning, of course, a C4 rotation axis. The second kind of symmetry element, shown in frame 5, is that of a mirror plane, reflection in which turns one half of the molecule into the other half, or, if you prefer, reflection in which turns the whole molecule into itself. Mirror planes are denoted by a Greek letter, a little sigma. You'll see it in frame 5 along with the suffixes V and H. These suffixes I'll explain in a moment. Examples of the third type of symmetry element are shown in frame 6. This is the centre of symmetry. It's denoted by the letter little I. The fourth type of symmetry element is in frame 7. This is one that you'll probably find rather less obvious, and for that reason, it's rather interesting. These elements involve two steps, first rotation and then reflection, and so they're called rotation-reflection axes of symmetry. They're denoted by a capital S with a number used as a suffix. So, for example, we can talk of an S6 axis. Lastly, there is the apparently trivial symmetry element which consists of doing nothing, leaving an object alone. This seems trivial, but we have to include the element because we are really talking about a mathematical theory, and we need something in the algebra which corresponds to multiplication by the number 1 in ordinary arithmetic. Let's go back to frame 4 now and look at it in more detail. In frame 4, we see first a twofold rotation axis of symmetry. In the isosceles triangle, corner 1 is converted into corner 1 primed by an axis lying in the plane of the triangle. This is a twofold axis because it takes just two rotations to bring the triangle back to its original position. The first rotation turns it over, so too does the second, and so it brings us back to where we started. There are several other symmetry elements possessed by this isosceles triangle, but they don't need to concern us for the moment. Frame 4 also shows examples of threefold and fourfold axes. Unlike the C2 axes, these are perpendicular to the planes of the equilateral triangle and the square. It takes three steps for the equilateral triangle and four for the square to get back to where we started. Hence the choice of suffixes on C3 and C4. Both the equilateral triangle and the square, shown in figure 4, have twofold axes in the plane of the figure. Stop the tape and see if you can count how many. The square has more than the equilateral triangle. Frame 5 shows first an example of a mirror plane in which the front, rectangular face of the prism, is converted into the back face by reflection in a mirror plane. There are, in fact, three subclassifications of mirror planes which you will encounter. The Greek symbol sigma usually carries a subscript, either a V, an H, or a D. The subscript V means that the mirror plane is vertical with respect to the axis of highest symmetry in the molecule. The V in sigma V is the initial letter of the word vertical. Note the bit about the axis of highest symmetry. Before deciding whether or not a mirror plane should be called sigma V, you've first got to decide what is the axis of highest symmetry. So, at the top of frame 5, what is actually shown is a sigma V plane, because the twofold axis which the prism possesses, and which is the axis of highest symmetry, actually passes through the mirror plane. Put it another way. If the axis of highest symmetry is held vertically, the mirror plane is also vertical. There's a second sigma V mirror plane in the figure at the top of frame 5, although I've not drawn it in. I wonder if you can spot it. The diagram at the bottom of frame 5 shows a triangular prism where the axis of highest symmetry is a 3C3 axis. By the way, there are two dots in this diagram which I'd like you to ignore for the moment. The triangular prism in frame 5 has several vertical mirror planes which I've not shown in the diagram, but which you might try to spot. In addition, the prism has a single mirror plane, shown cross-hatched, which chops the prism in half. If the threefold axis, the axis of highest symmetry, is held vertically, then this unique mirror plane is in a horizontal position. It's therefore called a sigma H mirror plane, the suffix H being the initial letter of the word horizontal. The third sort of mirror plane is a so-called sigma D mirror plane. I'm not going to discuss it in detail at the moment, and I've not included a sketch of it in frame 5. D is the first letter of the word dihedral, and mirror planes of this sort are those which are halfway between two twofold axes. In fact, such a mirror plane interrelates two different twofold axes. The problem is that the symbol sigma D is not always very consistently used in texts, and so its definition gives rise to some ambiguity. Actually, the mirror planes that I asked you to look for in the prism at the bottom of frame 5 are sigma D's, because the prism contains some twofold axes, perpendicular to the C3 axis, which I've not drawn in either. The third type of symmetry element is shown in frame 6. It's an inversion in a centre of symmetry. When something has a centre of symmetry, a line drawn from any point on the object through the centre of symmetry passes through an equivalent point of the object, the same distance on the other side of the centre of symmetry. The hexagon shown at the top of figure 6 has just such a centre of symmetry at its centre. Indeed, centres of symmetry are invariably at the centre of gravity of a molecule. You might wonder why. Think about that a bit as you look at the other examples in frame 6. Note that the corollary is not true. Centres of gravity are not always centres of symmetry. Now, if you turn to frame 7, we come to rotation-reflection axes. At the top of the frame, I have drawn a molecule of alene. There are several symmetry elements which interchange the hydrogens at one end of the molecule, a twofold axis, and two mirror planes. But what of the pairs of hydrogens at either end? These pairs must be symmetry related because they're entirely equivalent. But just how are they symmetry related? The answer is the molecule has an S4 axis. Imagine that the molecule is rotated 90 degrees about the axis that I have drawn, so that hydrogen atom 1 comes forward, out of the paper. This turns the molecule as I have shown in the second diagram. Can you imagine what happens when this molecule is reflected in the mirror plane that I've shown in the second diagram? You get the third diagram. Now compare the first and third diagrams. They're identical, except for the labels on the hydrogen atoms. The rotation by 90 degrees, and then reflecting in a mirror plane perpendicular to the axis of rotation, together make up the S4 operation. Notice here I am using the word operation, and not axis or element, because I am showing something which is actually happening. A symmetry operation is most simply thought of as the act of doing whatever is implied by the existence of a symmetry element. The act of rotating in the case of a rotation axis, the act of reflecting in the case of a mirror plane, the act of inversion when there is a center of symmetry. I've given a more formal definition in frame 8. Operations, as I have mentioned before, will be of more concern to us than elements, and this is a convenient point at which to mention them in detail for the first time. Indeed, it's difficult to talk about an S4 axis. I personally find it much easier to talk about S4 operations. In frame 7, there's another example of a rotation-reflection axis, in this case an S6 axis. I've shown this operation in a rather more compact way, but in a way that I will use again later. Make sure you understand it. Note that neither the alene molecule nor the prism shown in frame 7 has a sigma H mirror plane. Similarly, the alene molecule doesn't have a C4 axis, and the prism doesn't have a C6. That is, the component operations that make up the S4 and S6 operations in the two examples are not themselves symmetry operations of the objects involved. That's not always the case. If you turn back to frame 5, you'll find that the prism shown in the lower diagram has an S3 axis. This operation turns the corners of the top triangular face into the corners of the bottom triangular face. In this case, the component bits of the S3 operations involve the C3 axis and the sigma H mirror plane shown. To convince yourself that the S3 operation really does do something that no other single operation can do, would you look at the dot in the top and the dot in the bottom face and see if you can show that an S3 operation turns the one into the other? When you have finished with that problem, you might like to try and show that an S2 operation is another name for inversion in a center of symmetry. Looking back at frame 6 and imagining an S2 axis to go through the center of each figure in any old direction might help with this one. Stop the tape while you do these problems. A problem with S3, S4, S6, or any other SN operation is that they seem to be something of a cheat. This is because they consist of two parts, whereas every other operation we've looked at apparently consists of only one. This is not as much of a cheat as it seems. In fact, every operation, even the identity, which we're going to talk about in a moment, can be shown to consist of two different operations in sequence, if you wish to look at it like that. So, for example, you can perhaps see from frame 9 that a C2 operation, which we saw before in frame 4, is equivalent to successive acts of firstly reflection in a sigma H mirror plane, followed by inversion in a center of symmetry. This is explained in detail in the frame, where you'll see that I've drawn a sigma H mirror plane and center of symmetry so that they're completely outside the triangle. Remember that a sigma H mirror plane is perpendicular to the principal rotation axis, a C2 axis in this case. There's nothing unique about the position of the sigma H mirror plane or the center of symmetry. They could be slid up and down the twofold axis together. The action of the sigma H or the I separately on the triangle would give it the position I've shown dotted in frame 9. For the sigma H operation, the corner A would be an image of the corner 1 primed, whilst for the I, it would be an image of the corner labelled 1. following the one operation by the other, has the effect of putting the triangle back in its original position with the corners 1 and 1 primed interchanged, which is just what the C2 rotation does. Can you see that? Finally, the identity symmetry element. That's the one that corresponds to leaving an object alone, in other words, doing nothing, so I've not included a diagram for it. Note that there is only one identity element for each object, not an infinite number. The identity element is equivalent to rotation by 360 degrees, which, obviously, will bring an object back to its original position. So, although there's an infinite number of potential C1 axes about which, in principle, you could rotate, there's only one result. It doesn't matter which axis you use, and so, really, there's only one operation and only a single identity element. The symbol used for the identity element is the capital letter E, although sometimes you'll find the capital letter I used instead. In frame 10, there is a diagram showing you how to make a cube. You'll need this for the next part of the tape, so if you haven't already made it, or if you don't have some other cube handy, will you please stop the tape and make it up now? I now want you to take your cube, look at it, and try to make a list of all its symmetry elements, not its operations, its symmetry elements. There'll be a variety of axes, a variety of mirror planes, and a variety of the other symmetry elements that we've been talking about. The list that you get will almost certainly be incomplete. It's usually the case that when you try to pick out the operations of a figure or a molecule, you end up with an incomplete list. The problem of how to handle an incomplete list is one that I shall be discussing with you shortly. But for the moment, take the cube, list each symmetry element you can see, and decide how many there are of each type, if you can see more than one of a given type of symmetry element. Whilst you're doing that, stop the tape. In looking at the symmetry elements of the cube, you were perhaps embarrassed by the large number that it possesses. The first one that I should mention and get out of the way is the identity element, the operation of leaving the cube unchanged. Obviously, this is a symmetry element possessed by every object, no matter how low its symmetry. The next symmetry element, which you've probably spotted, was a fourfold rotation axis, shown in frame 11. There are three of these. Each one passes through the midpoints of opposite pairs of faces. And so counting pairs of faces, or perhaps simpler, just counting the total number of faces and dividing by 2, is a convenient method of finding out how many fourfold axes the cube possesses. The answer is that, since a cube possesses 6 faces, it possesses 3 such fourfold rotation axes. This trick of associating geometrical features of a molecule or an object that you're looking at with the existence of axes is a very useful one to employ, because it largely overcomes the problem of twisting the cube around and then being uncertain whether or not you've counted a particular symmetry element more than once. Another symmetry element which the cube possesses is shown in frame 12. This is a threefold rotation axis. There are 4 of these threefold rotation axes, each one passing through pairs of opposite corners. So, in order to determine that number of different threefold rotation axes is 4, one simply counts the number of corners and divides by 2. As there are 8 corners, there are 4 different threefold rotation axes. You'll appreciate the physical reality of a rotation axis better if you hold your cube between opposite corners, between your finger and thumb, if you can, and then rotate it. The cube will look the same 3 times in a complete revolution, if you ignore small imperfections in your model. Suppose you did the same thing with a rectangular box of lower symmetry, a matchbox, for instance. What result would you get? Now turn to frame 13. If you look down the line joining midpoints of pairs of opposite edges of the cube, you'll discover that this line is a twofold axis. To find the number of these axes, it's simplest to count the number of edges of the cube and divide by 2. A cube has 12 edges, and so there are 6 twofold axes of this type. Perhaps you have already noticed some other twofold axes. These coincide with the fourfold axes that we've been talking about, but correspond to a rotation of 180 rather than 90 degrees implied by the fourfold rotation axes themselves. Of course, two rotations of 90 degrees in the same direction are equivalent to a single 180-degree rotation. But, as we've seen, the fact that a single operation is equivalent to two others carried out in succession is no argument against the separate existence of the single operation. There will be four twofold axes of this type, one corresponding to each of the fourfold axes. So, we have two sorts of twofold axes, and it's usual to distinguish the two sorts by writing one of them with a prime against the C2. In the case of the cube, the prime is usually added to the six twofold axes that go through midpoints of opposite edges. You'll see that I've done this in frame 13. All of the operations that we have been talking about so far are the so-called proper rotations. They consist of pure rotations, either of 360 degrees for the identity element, or by varying fractions of 360 degrees. There's a corresponding list of symmetry elements which correspond to what are usually called improper rotations. Improper means that for these operations you have to do something other than, or in addition to, simply rotate. Definitions of proper and improper rotations, together with examples of each, are given in frame 14. The first improper rotation that we shall consider is shown in frame 15. And apparently doesn't involve a rotation at all. It's inversion in the centre of symmetry, at the centre of gravity of the cube. It turns out that all improper rotations are equivalent to inversion, in a possibly fictitious centre of symmetry, followed by a pure rotation. Thus, I, inversion in the centre of symmetry, is itself equivalent to I followed by E, the identity, or 360-degree rotation, element. Next, we consider an improper rotation that will really test your power of three-dimensional thinking. This is the S4 axis, one we have already studied in detail, and one that's shown in frame 16. In the case of a cube, an S4 operation relates, for example, the corners of one face to the corners of the parallel face. Frame 16 shows a cube before and after application of an S4 operation. That the S4 operation does a unique job is best seen by looking at the stars I've drawn in the two diagrams. No single operation, other than an S4, interconnects them. Note that corresponding to each C4 axis, there is also an S4 axis. So it follows that there are three S4 axes in all. In frame 17, you see the improper rotation of reflection in a mirror plane. This mirror plane is perpendicular to a fourfold axis of the cube and effectively chops the cube in half. It's called a sigma H mirror plane because it's horizontal with respect to the axis of highest symmetry, the fourfold rotation axis. Note how I've defined the axis of highest symmetry. In a cube, we have C2, C3 and C4 axes. It's the one with the largest value of the subscript, which is the axis of highest symmetry. If we'd had a C5 axis, that would have been chosen as the axis of highest symmetry. Note too that we only consider proper rotations when choosing the axis of highest symmetry. In a moment, we shall meet S6 rotation axes, but because they're improper rotation axes, we ignore them when selecting the axis of highest symmetry. Note too that the axis of highest symmetry, the C4 axis, is not unique. There are three of them. That doesn't matter. The diagram in frame 17 shows just one sigma H plane, but really there are three in all, one for each C4 axis. We shall look at the other mirror planes in a moment, but first consider frame 18. Here we see some S6 symmetry elements. It shows a view of the cube looking down a threefold axis. Rotation about the threefold axis interrelates the corners 1, 2 and 3 to each other, but it's the S6 operation which relates the corners 4, 5 and 6 to the corners 1, 2 and 3, a situation rather reminiscent of the S4 operations we considered a few minutes ago, but there we were considering a top face and a bottom face. As shown in frame 19, an S6 operation involves rotation of 60 degrees, with the first step something that doesn't itself exist as a symmetry operation in the cube, and then reflection in a mirror plane which is perpendicular to the axis about which the 60 degree rotation was performed. That mirror plane doesn't exist either as an independent symmetry operation. However, combination of the two, 60 degree rotation and reflection in a perpendicular mirror plane, does indeed give a genuine symmetry operation, the S6. In frame 19, I've shown the unique nature of the S6 operation by including two starred points which are interconnected by no other single operation besides the S6. Just as for the C3 rotation axis, pairs of opposite corners characterize the S6 rotations. There are 8 corners in a cube, and so just 4 S6 elements. Finally, in frame 20, we turn to a second type of mirror plane. These mirror planes contain pairs of opposite edges of the cube. They also bisect the angle between two C2 axes. You may remember that when we first met mirror planes, I mentioned that, in addition to sigma Vs and sigma Hs, a third sort occurs, the so-called sigma Ds, where the D is the first letter of the word dihedral. These are similar to sigma Vs, but differ from them because they bisect the angle between two C2 axes. The word dihedral refers to these C2 axes. Evidently, these second sort of mirror plane are sigma Ds. There's one sigma D mirror plane for each pair of edges of the cube, and so a total of 6 sigma D mirror planes in all. If you make a list of the proper rotation symmetry elements and the improper rotation symmetry elements of the cube, you'll find an interesting result. I've summarized them in frame 21, and you'll see that there's a one-to-one correspondence between members of the two sets, and the order in which I've discussed them on this tape was chosen to bring this correspondence out. Now stop the tape and check that this one-to-one correspondence really does exist. There's another and more important job that I'd like you to do using the data in frame 21. That's to investigate in more detail the connection between the symmetry elements of a cube and the corresponding symmetry operations. For some elements, there'll be just a single corresponding operation, but for several elements, you'll find that there will be more than one operation. Would you stop the tape again now and try to write down a complete list of the symmetry operations of a cube using your list of symmetry elements in frame 21 as a guide. Let us consider the pure rotation operation elements first. If you examine the diagram in frame 22, you'll find that there are two ways of doing the C4 operation shown there. The C4 rotation operation could mean rotate by 90 degrees clockwise or rotate by 90 degrees anticlockwise. Similarly, from frame 23, you'll see that a C3 rotation element has corresponding to it two operations, rotation by 120 degrees clockwise or rotation by 120 degrees anticlockwise. This ambiguity doesn't exist in the case of C2 axes, nor indeed the corresponding mirror planes, because for C2 axes, for instance, clockwise and anticlockwise rotations give the same result. But the ambiguity does exist for the S4 and S6 elements shown in frame 24 and 25 respectively, because they are the improper rotation counterparts of the C4 and C3 symmetry elements. In the case of the S4 symmetry element, one can either rotate clockwise by 90 degrees or rotate anticlockwise by 90 degrees as the first step of the two-step operation. Frame 25 shows that in the case of the S6, one can either rotate 60 degrees clockwise or 60 degrees anticlockwise as the first step. It's evident that there are more symmetry operations than there are symmetry elements for the cube. Quite frequently, but not invariably, this is the situation. It always happens when you meet a CN rotation axis where n is greater than 2. It's usual to group all of the operations of the same sort, the members of a particular class, together. Now, the definition of class is really a mathematical one, but as far as we're concerned, it's pretty well described as those operations which are derived from the same set of symmetry elements. And that's the definition I've given in frame 26. So, we've found three different C4 rotation axes. For each of these, there are two operations, rotation clockwise and rotation anticlockwise. So, there's a total of six C4 operations. These six C4 operations are usually just written as 6C4 and not distinguished from one another, although sometimes, in some applications, you do have to treat them individually. These six operations are all in the same class. Similarly, you write 8C3 as the class containing all the clockwise and anticlockwise rotations associated with the four C3 axes. In the same way, we also write 6S4 and 8S6. However, there's just one identity operation, as I've pointed out earlier. We have, then, operations grouped into classes in the way I've shown in frame 27. They are E, 8C3, 6C4, 3C2, 6C2 primed, I, 8S6, 6S4, 3 sigma H, and finally 6 sigma D, a total of 48 operations. A useful rule which helps you to check that you've picked out all of the symmetry operations of a molecule or a polyhedron is the fact that the total number of operations is divisible exactly by the number of operations in any one class. For the 8C3, we have 8 operations in a class. 48, the total number of operations in the group, divided by 8 is 6, and that's an integer. And so on for all of the other classes of symmetry operations in the group. If you had made a mistake counting the operations in a class, or overlooked whole classes of operations, as can happen, you'd have found that the number of operations in the group, which incidentally is called the order of the group, wouldn't be a multiple of the number of symmetry operations in each class, and so you'd know you'd made a mistake. I've just used a new word. I've referred to a group. I talked about the order of the group. A complete set of symmetry operations is referred to as a group of symmetry operations. The division rule that I gave to you a few minutes ago is one you check that you can use to make sure that a group is complete. We'll meet another test shortly. When talking about molecules, we don't usually talk just about a group of symmetry operations. Rather, we talk about the point group of the molecule. The word point is added because all the symmetry elements, note that I said elements, not operations, pass through at least one common point. In the case of the cube, this point is at the centre of mass. Indeed, the symmetry elements of a molecule always pass through the centre of mass. If I want to explain the word point in terms of symmetry operations, I have to recognize that there's at least one point in a molecule, its center of mass, which doesn't move no matter which operation is applied. At least one point stays put. This is a characteristic of the groups we're interested in, and so we call them point groups. If you feel you've understood our discussion of the cube, well done. I hope that you can now see the cube in a new light. If you're at all unhappy, stop the tape and go back and try again. It's important to have a grasp of the ideas we've met so far, because they're fundamental to the application of symmetry to chemical problems. We're about to start on the chemistry, so this is a convenient point at which to pause. You've seen frame 28 before, it's frame 1 back again. You should be able to understand more of it now, and to see how far we have yet to go. Stop the tape for a few moments, look at frame 28, and make sure that you feel happy about those parts of it which cover ground we've already met before you carry on.
That completes the first part of Symmetry in Chemistry. The presentation continues on the second cassette, but before listening to this, you're advised to again read through the sections of the booklet that you've already covered, together with any notes that you've taken. Make quite certain that you understand all the material that has been presented before you proceed any further, and, if necessary, go through parts or all of this tape again.